Hello everyone, you're listening to the Western Plains Cultural Centre podcast series. Today we're focusing on Auditorium, which is the latest exhibition in the main gallery space, and this exhibition comes to us from the Powerhouse Museum. Joining me today is Jess, our collections officer.
Hi.
Kent, our curator.
Hello.
And Andrew, our manager.
Good afternoon.
The Auditorium is an innovative and playful exhibition that comes to us from the Powerhouse Museum, and it's based on a unique concept as part of a successful collaboration between them and Sean Tan, award-winning children's author and illustrator. Tan's brief was to concoct fantastical stories behind a selection of especially unusual museum objects. Jess, the what-if mechanism is being used as a part of Auditorium, and in their material that accompanies the exhibition, they state that this is a useful mechanism in a museum context, legitimising collections as machines for thinking. In your opinion, what place do fictional narratives have in a museum context?
I think increasingly an important place to play. I think that museums are going through a pretty fundamental shift, and they have been for the last 10 years or so, and are focusing less on, you know, facts, dates, who did what when, and more about experiences and getting people to understand why things happened and how things happened, and realising and understanding that there are multiple interpretations of a single event, depending on your age, your gender, your background, your, you know, political viewpoint. So I think there's a lot to be said for encouraging people to look at museums and collections that they hold as being the starting point for discussion. And that discussion can be creative and fictional, but I think it's encouraging people to look at museums as the beginning of the questions, not the answers, not the final point of a statement of fact.
Sean Tan says something interesting in his preamble to his book. He says, "So away you go, amuse yourself at their expense, because secretly we think objects love being useful."
I think people will, however many labels you put on something, people are going to bring their own interpretation to an object. And I think it would be a very boring experience for the museum goer and the museum worker to have one object with one interpretation and one meaning. That's not why we all love objects and the stories that they tell us. So I don't think that's what we should expect the visitors to have, that same limited experience. So I really do think people should look at the things that we put into exhibitions and the things that we put into museums as being a point of raising ideas, rather than being the end point of the discussion.
All right, Kent, in thinking about the fictional side of things, the Auditorium features a quite innovative and fresh take to museum labelling in inviting Sean Tan and visiting people who view the exhibition, particularly children, to create their own labels. What do you think the impact of this is within the space?
I think for the visitor, it's a fabulous opportunity for them to engage with an exhibition or with objects in a much more richer way than just reading what it is and moving along to the next object. I think it's interesting, as in the art world, we view an artwork or an object as the approximation of an idea or an aesthetic, whereas we are very used to a museum presenting objects with a factual use and really potentially only one story. This opportunity that the show provides is for us to start looking at these objects from a lot of different angles. So whilst a telephone may only have one purpose, we may look at it in terms of an object within a home, a domestic setting, the fact that telephones have had a design history that does treat them as if they're an object to look at and admire. So that's one example of looking at a telephone differently than what it was made for. And as Jess said, this provides the opportunity for us to think about differently about those objects and bring in a whole range of ideas about those objects that we may not necessarily find out by just looking at the label that tells us exactly what it is. I think the beauty of a show like this is that children particularly are able to look at an object, and if they don't know what it is, could come up with really lovely ideas about what it is. Interestingly, the show has been very successful in that regard. There's a number of people I've spoken to who have actually believed the labels. you know, that the big licorice all short, all sorts, shoe, many people think it is a training object for blind dogs. guide dogs for blind people. And that's, you know, it's fascinating that people accept that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the opportunity for people to think really differently about what they're looking at, I think is a really lovely idea.
Absolutely.
One thing, though, following on from the telephone, do you think that the objects in this show, they have to be carefully chosen to be, for want of a better phrase, unimportant? I mean, if you had, say, a phone that was used in Auschwitz during the Holocaust, would it be acceptable to rewrite your captions about what that phone could be? I mean, is this show spine up to a point? Can we do this with objects that have no sort of lasting impact of their own? They're just sort of like fripperies or ephemeral. And if people are walking out thinking that that giant licorice all sort shoe is a training guide for guide dogs for the blind, what have they learnt? What is the point of the show? You know, it begins to me, and look, I like the show, but it raises a lot of issues that I don't think it really thought that it was raising.
I agree. I think that in getting people to look at an object and interpret the object in fictional ways, I do ask the question, what is the point in terms of... I suppose the point is that the show as a whole, conceptually, is saying one thing. Whether or not it's probably not good that we walk away thinking that that shoe is guide dog training object, when of course it isn't. So maybe that might be the hole in the concept, that potentially people will walk away with a fictional idea of what these objects are, as opposed to their use.
I think auditorium also represents an extreme
in
terms of the concept being pushed as far as possible that you could go.
Mm.
But I think it does represent an idea that can be incorporated into more museums and more exhibitions about the diversity of interpretations and the diversity of approaches to objects. Mm. So I certainly think that, for example, if you had something that had real historical significance, it's not about creating a fictional interpretation of that object, but more highlighting that there is no one fixed interpretation of it, that there are multiple interpretations.
Mm.
And encouraging, you know, if you explain to a child about, for example, an object from Auschwitz and got them to interpret it, it's going to be completely different if you've got an 80-year-old woman or an 80-year-old person.
Mm.
That's not to say that those interpretations are not legitimate in themselves. So I think auditorium is a really great example of how far we can push it. But it at its core, I think it represents a really good idea about how facts and dates and historical truth is open to multiple interpretations.
I think that, I mean, if we look really, I suppose, at the premise of the show, it is about allowing a non-museum person, I suppose, a writer, a children's book illustrator and writer, into, you know, his aim was to look at those anomalies in the collection, those objects that maybe we don't know a lot about, or they are certainly from another time, or maybe fictional in the first instance. So I'm thinking of something like the Dragon's Blood, which has a basis in a kind of a fact, I suppose. There is such a plant as a...
Dragon's blood,
thank you. Yeah, dragon's blood. But of course, he's dealing with, you know, this vial, this old kind of science kind of object, and draws the ideas out from that.
I think it is an interesting point of departure for museum exhibitions in total, but I also think it's been really tightly targeted, because in having objects that are in themselves don't have any real import to them, and then targeting it at kids so that we can say, oh, kids, they've got wild, crazy imaginations, you know, aren't they gorgeous and all that sort of stuff. We're getting away from the fact that, taken to the extreme, this idea of what an object can mean, it doesn't bring out what I could refer to, almost the dark side of it. Like, if you were to look at the history of Australia from the 1950s, written by someone who was opposed to immigration of all forms, took every object and everything that happened in this country from that viewpoint, would that be an acceptable museum exhibition?
Mm-hmm.
The same could be said for climate change people and all sort, you know, creationists and so on, anyone who takes something that, oh, this is what I'm going to construct, and really the truth of what that object is of no import to me. It's only what I want to say about it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's an interesting idea, but it's been really carefully targeted so that it doesn't become offensive. But I think that idea could become offensive very easily.
Yes. And I think that's probably, it's in this vein where you get those museums across America in particular that focus on a particular viewpoint of history, and they set their museums up according to that viewpoint. And I think if you had museums developing along this line, then it needs to be made perfectly clear to the visitor that this is the experience that they're going to get when they come in, because you do run the risk of, as Kent mentioned, the amount of people that read the labels, the fictional labels, and believe. There is an inherent trust that people have in museums that this exhibition plays around with and highlights, but it's not something that we should, in the museum world, throw away because it's something very valuable and something that we work very hard to build. So you don't want to create an environment where people believe nothing that we say.
Well, I mean, but we used to believe the 6 o'clock newsreader. I mean, the 6 o'clock newsreader 20 years ago was the most trusted figure in the country, and now,
give or take.
Yeah, you know, they come, they go. But, you know, maybe museums, that's part of the modern society, is that you don't trust anyone, and so museums will simply fall into line.
Well, from an education point of view, in the senior study of history and ancient history, they're taught to question every source.
Yes.
And every source has to be backed up by another source. You know, they have to compile evidence in order to prove before they believe. They don't believe the first thing they read. And that's definitely, you know, that's what it's about, and that's what it's teaching them.
It's such a tradition in history and museum practice that, you know, you're right, every source is, you know, questioned and double-checked and, you know, triple-checked and da-da-da-da-da. So it is something that we as museum professionals are not used to either, but, you know, I think it's a great idea, however many kind of conditions we put on it, I think it opens up a particularly interesting avenue for exploration.
I think also it's an interesting use of a collection, and I think, you know, it's something that Powerhouse have done. Powerhouse have got a reputation. They have a very museological focus. They have a design focus. There's a number of sort of rigor, you know, there's a lot of rigor within what they do. And it begs the question that maybe other institutions may not be able to do it in the same way that the Powerhouse has done it.
Would those be the ones that have rigor mortis?
Possibly. Because I think that there is, here we have the opportunity to show, say, you know, the shoes by Vivian Westwood, which ordinarily would probably only be curated within a show of fashion and design. There'd be no reason to pull those out, really, for any other thing that I can, you know, think of right now. But to be able to pull that into a show where we can look at those objects in an entirely different way, rather than the technicalities of how they were made or, you know, the culture from which they came, etc. That in a sense, maybe the show is just about that and only that. That the expectation is not to learn something about the object, that it is about just using these objects that are kind of strange in themselves, that of course do have, you know, a proper label and a proper context and, you know, a proper history, that really the aim of the show is to make us think differently about what we're looking at and maybe question what we're looking at. If we look at the label wall, children have gone crazy with that.
Absolutely.
And I observed a young boy who was doing it on the weekend, and his mother wanted to move to another part of the gallery, and he got quite annoyed with her because he was halfway through writing, you know, his blurb. And thankfully afterwards I went and read his blurb after he left, and it was a really intense, really interesting blurb. So I think that it's worked in that regard. I think in terms of making people, and in particular children, look differently at things, and I suppose open up what they already have, which is a kind of an exploratory kind of, you know, view of the world, then it's very successful in that regard. And maybe we as museum people are kind of, you know, thinking, oh,
overthinking it.
These are objects. but really, in terms of what the show is called and the aim of the show, it is really about looking at these objects in a very different way and bringing disparate objects together that would ordinarily not have any relationship to each other. So I think, you know, in many respects, it's healthy for an organisation such as Powerhouse to be able to think creatively about how it's presented, and maybe start using some of those objects that, you know, may not get pulled out for, you know, decades maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the opportunity. And maybe, you know, which isn't something that isn't sort of so obvious to us, but maybe we need to draw out, is that it does say something about collection. And it says something about why we collect and the stories, whether true or untrue, that can be built up around objects. And as we all know, when we search for truth, you know, we find lots of untruths as well. And often those untruths are there for a reason, either because that's how, you know, the story of an object developed. And so, you know, there's aspects to the show that haven't been explored in that in great detail, but certainly sort of set us off on these kind of questions.
Okay, to finish off, we're going to think about why we're odd. So understanding that odd only becomes so in terms of your own concept of normal, why do you think you're odd?
I don't think we are.
Yes, we are. We all have something odd about ourselves.
Physically? Well, one of my toes is crooked. I don't know. I think, you know, look, everyone is odd, but if everyone's odd, then everyone's normal. It's that circular argument that goes off. And I think there are certainly people who are much more odd than I am banging around the streets of Dubbo. And I don't know. I think I'm relatively normal. Perhaps it's my normality that makes me odd.
Makes you odd.
Yeah, I think it's also, whilst Andrew may think he's normal, others may think he's odd. And
look at that beard.
Thankfully, whilst you're listening to this, you can't see anything. But, you know, there's certainly things that we may think about ourselves and you know, assume that they're odd. You know, I would say, you know, I don't like sport. I'm not interested in sport. Does that make me odd? I don't know. I mean, in some respects, yes, that's odd.
But not in the art world. Not in the art world.
Not necessarily, no.
Yeah.
You'd
be odd if you won the Archibald Prize and played for Australia.
That would be odd, yeah. One person's odd is another person's normal.
Mm-hmm. But in any given day, if I walked into, you know, the free sheds on a Sunday afternoon, I would feel odd because I'm out of place.
Out of context.
I walk to work every morning, I don't feel odd. Mm-hmm. So I think in any given day, depending on what you do and where you do it, you can feel odd. But I think oddness is more an external thing than an internal thing.
Mm.
I think, you know, in terms of sort of people, when you feel odd or when you think people are being odd, it's because something's happening outside of your control. I don't think I walk around every day going, oh, God, I feel odd.
Mm.
But it's when something outside of my world changes, that's when I feel odd. I think it's far more into an external, forced upon us thing than something inherent in everybody walking around the stage and down.
Yeah, I think also, you know, with the rise of the online realm, you know, even if we have some strange view of the world, chances are there'll be
someone
one
out there.
So, you know, and I think
as
also
odd as that viewpoint might be.
That's right, but I think also odd tends to shifts and changes. So one thing that may be viewed as odd 10 years later is not so odd. And so, you know, I think our notion of what is not the norm constantly evolves and changes, and we get used to things. And sometimes odd can just be something that we aren't familiar with. And then after a time we become quite used to it and realise that it's not odd after all.
And I think, if anything, that this show shows us is that oddness is something to be embraced.
Yes.
For its fun and its, you know, silliness and reminding us of what is important in life, and that's that as odd as each of us are, we're all interesting, exciting sort of creatures that, you know, even, I mean, some of the sort of objects in the show seem incredibly straightforward, but if you look at them slightly skewed, they become odd. And that's something we should celebrate.
Well, the closer you look at something, the odder it becomes.
Yeah.
And also I think it is a really nice message for children who are, in a sense, trying desperately to be like everyone else. No one wants to be different. No one wants to be odd necessarily. particularly when you're growing up, because you really do just want to be with the status quo and not rock the boat. But I think there is a really nice message about oddness and about how we are all odd in a sense, and that that should be celebrated and highlighted as something that proves that, you know, we're a diverse culture, and, you know, without that oddness, life is essentially quite boring.
All right. Okay, on that note, we'll leave it there. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.